American Free Press Audio Edition Issue 47 and 48, November 18 and 25, 2019. Assange tortured in London jail cell, WikiLeaks whistleblower is being denied legal and basic humanitarian rights, by St. Patrick. For 2 weeks, supporters and friends of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange have been dumbfounded by what happened at the whistleblower's U.S. extradition hearing in a London courtroom. Did this happen in the home of the Magna Carta? Asked Australian filmmaker John Pilger, referring to Britain's chief constitutional document, a symbol of global liberty that some still believe is the most important constitutional document of all time. Pilger later answered his own question, "Yes, but who knew?" The Assange extradition trial went off almost unnoticed until it had concluded. The BBC and other channels blacked it out, refusing to air the trial that Pilger likened to a newsreel of a show trial in Joseph Stalin's Russia. By all accounts of the minimal eyewitnesses present, Vanessa Barrett, Sayre, a magistrate, because the court apparently didn't see the trial as inconclusive enough to use an actual judge, sneered at Assange, speaking to him with arrogance and condescension. When Assange or his representation spoke, Barrett seemed bored and disinterested, the outcome predetermined. When the prosecution presented its case, continuously aided by a U.S. representative who repeatedly took notes to the prosecutor as the hearing progressed, the magistrate livened up, listening intently to the prosecution's case. As if this hearing wasn't already beset by a media blackout, Barrett assigned the next hearing to a remote locale at Woolwich, which adjoins Belmarsh Prison, with even fewer seats made available to the public. Most commentators defending Assange in the state of global journalism will not be allowed inside. After rejecting the Assange team's request for additional preparation time, Assange has been denied access to legal documents and research, by which he could defend himself, ensuring that the next hearing will be as secret as can be while still being officially public. Was yet another dagger into the state of free speech in the free press and court. News gathering organization Reuters described Assange, 48, as confused, struggling to answer questions about his name and age. He has spent 7 years barricaded inside Ecuador's British embassy and, since April, has been in a permanent state of solitary confinement where sensory deprivation and a lack of access to humanity are his new normal. The inhumane imprisonment is designed to break him before he is ultimately sent to the United States to answer for 18 counts, including hacking government computers and violating parts of the Espionage Act. A vital, motivated, lively Assange is a heavyweight contender who has built a career on courage, exposing the worst misdeeds of the most powerful governments, financial power brokers, and militaries in the world. When he appears before a judge in the U.S., he will stand as a shell of that Assange. When Barrett asked him if he understood what was happening, Assange replied, "Not really," before attempting to expose the conditions in which he has been forced to live, stating that he was unable to think properly. Assange said, "I don't understand how this is equitable. I can't research anything, I can't access any of my writing, it's very difficult where I am." WikiLeaks editor Kristen Hrafnsson argued on social media that the case should have been thrown out. Not only is it illegal on the face of the treaty, the U.S. has conducted illegal operations against Assange and his lawyers, which are the subject of a major investigation in Spain. Hrafnsson is referring to a charge that the CIA used the Spanish security company Undercover Global SL, hired to protect the embassy during Assange's time there, to spy on Assange and his attorneys during the stay in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Spain's highest court, the Audiencia Nacional, is investigating Undercover Global SL and its owner, David Morales. In the words of Pilger, no one doubts, not his enemies at the New York Times, not the Murdoch press in Australia, that if he is extradited to the United States and the inevitable supermax, journalism will be incarcerated, too. Once there were spaces, gaps, bolt holes in mainstream journalism in which mavericks, who are the best journalists, could work. These are long closed now. The hope is the Sami's dot on the internet, where fine disobedient journalism is still practiced, rather than reporting on the farce of a hearing that occurred in London. The American mass media focused instead on Assange's confused answers and his denial of extension. The undertone is one of punishment. Had he only played ball with the U.S. government and the world's most powerful financiers, had he only attended a proper journalism school, had he only gumshoed it at an established newspaper in a metro area for decades first, he would be worth defending. Instead, he formed his own journalistic organization and dedicated himself to exposing the darkest areas of geopolitical maneuvers, doing what the mainstream media throughout the world refuses to do. He is everything they are not, and the alternative media should unite and hope that he is everything we are. Deep state mad Trump won't lie for them. In a lengthy article for The Atlantic magazine published late last month that was titled Trump's Character a Threat to Foreign Policy, Elliot Cohen, one of the leading voices for neoconservatism, whined that Donald Trump lacks the character, values, and experience to be president and, as a result, is trashing decades of allegedly well-planned and enacted U.S. foreign policy. Ironic that this magazine, which, in its founding statement claimed to be focused on freedom, national progress, and honor, whether public or private, would turn to an individual like Cohen to critique the president. But he is what many consider to be one of the more prominent faces behind the deep state, that highly paid, loud, chattering class of unelected beltway insiders and prominent intellectuals, who have, for the past seven decades, been the loudest cheerleaders for every foolish intervention that America has been involved in, from Vietnam to Afghanistan to Iraq to Libya to Syria and beyond. Of course, Cohen didn't go straight at the president's policy decisions. Instead, he took shots at Trump's character, which, to be fair, is kind of low-hanging fruit. It's not like anyone with a straight face is defending the moral qualities of the president, with his history of marital infidelity and financial profiteering. We do believe Trump loves this country. Cohen, however, like so many in the Washington establishment, has no shame. After all, he is just one of many who, themselves, have had no problems lying to the American people when it comes to promoting wars that are not in the best interests of the United States. Perhaps Cohen has forgotten that, in the run-up to Iraq War II, he was a featured name on the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq, pressing President George W. Bush to invade that country. But now that it has been accepted that Iraq intervention is the worst strategic disaster in American history, which has cost, by some estimates, the lives of a million Iraqis, does Cohen admit his role in selling the war? Does he hide his face in shame? Of course not. Ever the chicken hawk, Cohen concedes that Iraq War II was a mistake, but rather than accept responsibility for his own spirited and flawed advocacy of the war, he blames poor intelligence, despite the fact that many in U.S. intelligence as well as politicians on both the left and the right at the time were warning him that it would be a catastrophic blunder to invade that Mideast country. Perhaps the thing that bothers Cohen so much about Trump is not the fact that Trump often does not tell the whole truth, but that Trump, with his plain talk, often inadvertently pulls the curtain back to reveal the real goals of the deep state. For example, everyone knows, but few in the establishment would concede, that financial profit is a primary concern of those planning wars. Thus, the vast majority of wars are inevitably fought for control of natural resources. For deep state actors like Cohen, though, they would much prefer a malleable president who is willing to lie to the American people and sell lofty goals like democracy and freedom as reasons for going to war. They do not like it when presidents tell the truth, as did President Trump when he admitted that the U.S. military is in northern Syria to secure the oil for America. Plain and simple, the deep state wants us all to believe that U.S. forces were stationed in northern Syria simply to protect the oil fields for the benefit of the Kurdish people. This way, all of those wonderful Kurds we had just stabbed in the back would be bathing in money, the well-deserved recipients of the revenue stream that now is, certainly, being sent directly to them. Why does a large segment of the population not know the truth about our real reasons for being in northern Syria? Why do people believe that U.S. troops secured those oil fields for the Kurds? Because lapdog establishment news outlets like Vox say so. Rather than figure it out for themselves, Vox just enthusiastically repeated what they had been told in a press release from the Pentagon, and we all know that the Pentagon would never lie. This is one example of why people need American free press. to filter through the mainstream propaganda on important subjects and present you with the truth. Right now we are running a half-price special on AFP Christmas gift subscriptions. A full year of AFP for a friend, colleague or family member is just $29. We hope you will take advantage of this special gift offer. See page 12 for the form you will need to complete and mail back to AFP. Christopher J. Petherick, Executive Editor. Left Targets Free Expression and Fight Over Hate Speech, by John Friend. The Tyrannical Assault on the First Amendment and Freedom of Speech, Thought, and Inquiry has reached a whole new level, as establishment spokesmen and media outlets openly advance the notion that America needs hate speech laws. In a recently published opposite the editorial page in the Washington Post, Richard Stengel, a former high-ranking State Department official under Presidents Barack Obama and a former editor of Time magazine, argued that the United States should consider enacting hate speech laws similar to the tyrannical laws in many European countries that criminalize such things as Holocaust denial and incitement of racial and religious hatred. These types of laws have effectively been used to persecute and punish any individual investigating complex and disputed aspects of history, particularly relating to World War II, as well as those who criticize massive Third World immigration into the West, refugee resettlement, globalism more generally, and other politically incorrect topics. All speech is not equal, Stengel hypocritically argues in his opposite the editorial page, and where truth cannot drive out lies, we must add new guardrails. I'm all for protecting thought that we hate, but not speech that incites hate. The very concept of hate speech, long promoted by organizations such as the ADL and SPLC, essentially amounts to any criticism of any aspect of the New World Order agenda and the forces behind it. Freedom of Speech, Thought, and Historical and Scientific Inquiry, bedrocks of the American political tradition specifically and Western civilization more generally, have increasingly been undermined and eroded by private entities such as Google, YouTube, and Twitter that censor and punish dissenting opinions on their platforms. Individuals expressing politically incorrect opinions also increasingly face the risk of becoming targets of radical left-wing organizations and activists, such as Antifa, that work tirelessly to publicly shame and expose thought criminals, often leading to social ostracization and loss of employment. With establishment figures openly pushing for hate speech laws, the Senate and House have both established bipartisan task forces for combating anti-Semitism, an initiative lobbied for by the Zionist lobby dominating Capitol Hill in an effort to punish those who criticize Israel on the pro-Zionist policies promoted by the D.C. establishment. Jonathan Greenblatt, the CEO of the ADL, praised the recently established task force, arguing that we must all come together to fight the rise in anti-Semitism that threatens communities everywhere. Ronald Lauder, the president of the World Jewish Congress, likewise has called for more laws to combat anti-Semitism, especially online anti-Semitism. After three decades, anti-Semitism has now reared its head, Lauder said in part during the recently concluded Second World Jewish Congress International Meeting of Special Envoys and Coordinators for Combating Anti-Semitism. We want laws that really mean something, of course, to them. Anti-Semitism is not just about racism against Jewish people, it includes criticism of Israel as a way to muzzle opposition to that country's policies. Additionally, local and federal officials have even launched investigations into harmless flyers simply declaring it's okay to be white at various universities across the country in an effort to determine if those responsible for posting the flyers committed a hate crime. At Oklahoma City University School of Law, investigators are searching for the man who posted the flyers to determine his intent and whether the actions are a hate crime. According to a local ABC affiliate in Oklahoma, similar flyers were posted on the campus of Western Connecticut State University recently, prompting an official investigation by local and state police as well as the FBI. University President John Clark described the posting of the flyers as an attack on our university community and assured students that his office is making every effort to see that those responsible are caught and properly punished. The trouble is, Even if the posters of these flyers only intended to state the obvious in protest of the vilification of white people, especially on college campuses, and never intended violence, it wouldn't matter to leftists. Once their identities are exposed, they will be harassed, threatened, fired from their jobs, and likely driven from society, all because they had the audacity to try to push back against the establishment today. New movie stands up for First Amendment. By Mark Anderson. The newly released pro-free speech docudrama No Safe Spaces, You Have the Right to Remain Silent, is finding more safe spaces through which to air its vital message that our long, cherished First Amendment is not only being devalued in mainly leftist venues such as universities, it's also being wildly attacked and could go asunder unless we put an end to broadening censorship. At its debut in Phoenix, the film scored the second largest opening for a documentary on a single screen in history after Michael Moore's Sicko, according to a press release from its producers. No Safe Spaces, co-starring conservative radio talk show host Dennis Prager and comedian and podcast king Adam Carolla, continued its market expansion in South Carolina and Florida, taking in an estimated $65,000. The film will also be shown in Los Angeles, Sacramento, Fresno, Kansas City, Minneapolis, Salt Lake City, Orlando, and San Antonio. In No Safe Spaces, Carolla and Prager travel America to talk to experts and advocates on the left and the right, visiting college campuses while examining their own upbringings to try to understand what is happening in America today and what free speech in this country should look and sound like. The press release noted, an even more familiar figure in the docudrama is comedian Tim Allen, known for his oft-censored, conservative-flavored sitcom Last Man Standing. In a panel discussion in the film, he observes, "Isn't it spooky we're having this discussion? It's spooky even thinking about that you have to be modulated. I'm a little alarmed about things that I cannot say. I do it anyway, but it is weird that I'm thinking about self-censoring." The documentary shows an on-stage discussion, which was held on February 15, 2017 at Cal State Northridge. Carolla tells Prager about his assumed white privilege. With regards to a semi-heated debate Carolla had via radio with an accomplished black man who had earned a University of Michigan law degree and whose black wife also had a successful career, he went on to explain to me that I didn't know what I was talking about because of my white privilege, Carolla related. And I said, "Well, let's examine my white privilege, may we?" I said I got out of North Hollywood High. I did not go to college. I worked cleaning carpets. Later on, I worked on construction sites, digging ditches, picking up after the carpenters. I felt like my white privilege wasn't kicking in. Mom was on food stamps and welfare. Dad was eking out a living. Notably, the docudrama covers a lot of other ideological ground and features conservative political commentator Ben Shapiro, CBS commentator reporter Cheryl Atkinson, black liberal, leaning CNN contributor and political commentator Van Jones, gay classical liberal commentator Dave Rubin, young black conservative and Trump defender Candace Owens, conservative media pundit and former Trumper Ann Coulter, and Canadian psychology professor Jordan Peterson, who frequently challenges political correctness. These contributors lament the stark reality of today's students flashing out at any speaker brave enough to say something they disagree with. Precious snowflakes demanding safe spaces to protect them from any idea they haven't heard from their liberal professors. The ongoing attack on free speech and free thought began in the universities, but, fair warning, it's coming to your neighborhood and your workplace, the movie's promoters stated. Free Speech on the Ropes is criticism of Israel, already an official hate crime in America, by Philip Giraldi. One subject that congressmen and the mainstream media tend to avoid is the erosion of fundamental liberties in the United States as a consequence of the war on terror and American involvement in the Middle East. Some of America's legislators apparently do not even understand that freedom of speech actually means that one can say things that others might find distasteful. The assault on freedom of speech has been accelerated through the invention of so-called hate speech, which has in turn morphed into hate crimes where punishments are increased if there is any suggestion that hatred of groups or individuals is involved. Some have rightly questioned the whole concept, pointing out that if you murder someone, the result is the same whether you hate your victim or not. Freedom of speech is particularly threatened in any situations having to do with Israel, a reflection of the power of that country's lobby in the United States. At a recent town hall gathering, Rep. Dan Crenshaw, R. Texas, demonstrated how he and his colleagues run and hide whenever the issue of Israel is raised, when he would not respond directly to a question over whether any criticism of Israel should or should not be protected under the First Amendment. Crenshaw is a Republican and generally reliably conservative, though he recently spoke out against the For the People Act of 2019, which he claimed would limit free speech dramatically. A constituent specifically asked Crenshaw's opinion about federal laws that require citizens in some states to sign a pledge that they will not boycott Israel if they wish to get government contracts or obtain a government job. The audience member also mentioned a law passed in Florida that bans anti-Semitism in public schools and universities, defining anti-Semitism as criticism of Israel. The constituent observed, "These laws are obviously flagrant and troubling violations of the First Amendment to free speech. Will you honor your oath and denounce these laws here, now and forever?" Crenshaw was then asked. Crenshaw quickly fired back that the critic was cloaking yourself in the First Amendment to enable engaging in vehement anti-Semitism. Crenshaw then asserted that the questioner was advocating the BDS movement, a recent target of much of the legislation that the critic was addressing. BDS refers to the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which calls on people to protest Israel by pulling investments from and boycotting the country. Israel is engaged in what might be described as a war with the objective of driving any and all criticism of the Jewish state out of polite discourse, making it illegal wherever and whenever possible. The Knesset has passed legislation criminalizing anyone who supports BDS and has set up a semi-clandestine group called Kelah Shlomo to counteract its message. The country's education minister has called BDS supporters enemy soldiers and has compared them to Nazis. Netanyahu has also backed up the new law with a restriction on foreigners who support the BDS movement entering the country, including American Jewish dissidents, several of whom have been turned around at the airport and sent home. Israel has been particularly successful at promoting its own preferred narrative, together with sanctions for those who do not concur, in the English-language speaking world and also in France, which has the largest Jewish population in Europe. The U.S. government under Donald Trump is completely under the thumb of the Israeli Prime Minister's office, with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo recently saying our major focus is stamping out anti-Semitism. Sanctions already in place in Europe consist of fines and even jail time. The legal penalties come into play for those criticizing Israel or questioning the accuracy of the accepted Holocaust narrative, that is, disputing that 6 million died, even attacking specific Israeli government policies, like its slaughter of Palestinians in Gaza every Friday, can be found guilty of anti-Semitism, which is now considered a hate crime in Britain, France, Germany, and, most recently, the Czech Republic. In Britain, where the Jewish lobby is extremely strong, a law passed in December 2016 made the UK one of the first countries to use the definition of anti-Semitism agreed upon earlier in the year at a conference of the Berlin-based International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, IHRA. A statement from the British Prime Minister's office at that time explained that the intention of the new definition was to ensure that culprits will not be able to get away with being anti-Semitic because the term is ill-defined, or because different organizations or bodies have different interpretations of it. The British government's own definition relies on guidance provided by the IHRA, which asserts that it is considered anti-Semitic to accuse Jews of being more loyal to Israel or their religion than to their own nations, or to say the existence of Israel is intrinsically racist. In other words, even if many Jews are more loyal to Israel than to the countries they live in, and even though Israel is in fact intrinsically racist, it is now illegal to say so in Great Britain. One should not be surprised, as the British government's subservience to Jewish and Israeli interests is as nearly as enthusiastic as its government in the United States, though it is driven by the same sorts of things, Jewish money and Jewish power, particularly in the media. A majority of Conservative Party members of Parliament have joined Conservative Friends of Israel, and the Labour counterpart is also a major force to be reckoned with on the political left. Here in the United States, the Friends of Israel appear to believe that anyone who is unwilling to do business with Israel or even with the territories that it has illegally occupied should not be allowed to obtain any benefit from federal, state or even local governments. Constitutional guarantees of freedom of speech and association for every American are apparently not valid if one particular highly favored foreign country is involved, as the discussion with Crenshaw reveals. 27 states now have lost sanctioning those who criticize or boycott Israel, and one particular pending piece of federal legislation that is regularly reintroduced into the Senate would far exceed what is happening at the state level and would set a new standard for deference to Israeli interests on the part of the national government. It would criminalize any U.S. citizen engaged in interstate or foreign commerce who supports a boycott of Israel or who even goes about requesting the furnishing of information regarding it, with penalties enforced through amendments of two existing laws, the Export Administration Act of 1979 and the Export-Import Act of 1945, that include potential fines of between $250,000 and $1 million and up to 20 years in prison. Israel and its friends like Crenshaw are particularly fearful of the BDS movement because its nonviolence is attractive to college students, including many young Jews, who would not otherwise get involved on the issue. The Israeli government clearly understands, correctly, that BDS can do more damage than any number of terrorist attacks, as it represents a serious critique of the behavior of the Jewish state while also challenging the actual legitimacy of the Israeli government and its colonizing activity in Palestine. Much of the current hate crime legislation in places like Germany and the Czech Republic directly targets BDS, stating specifically that it is inherently anti-Semitic. In late July, the House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed its own resolution condemning BDS explicitly in a 398-17 vote. Going hand in hand with the condemnation of BDS is a drive to maintain the exclusivity of Jewish suffering. In June, when Rep. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, DNY, called border detention centers holding asylum seekers concentration camps, she was inundated with protests from Jewish groups that claimed she was denigrating the Holocaust and insulting victims of genocide. The United States Holocaust Memorial Museum even published a statement objecting to comparisons between the Holocaust and other events. It is important for Americans to realize that Israel not only spies on the U.S., digs its paws deep into our treasury, and perverts Washington's Middle East policy. It is also attempting to dictate what we the people can and cannot say, and Congress and much of the media are fully on board, which is the real tragedy. How the internet has controlled the practice of shadow banning and the art of stale censorship. By Dr. Kevin Barrett on October 17 I published an article headlined The Legal Lynching of a Truth Seeker, Jim Fetzer's Stalinist-Style Show Trial. In it I argued that Dr. James Fetzer, who lost a $450,000 libel judgment to Lenny Posner on October 15, didn't get a fair trial. My account was based on what I saw in the courtroom that day. According to a recent Reason post by Eugene Volokh, someone has been trying to get my article de-indexed from Google. Volokh notes that Posner had earlier successfully persuaded Google to de-index web pages featuring Fetzer's edited book Nobody Died at Sandy Hook due to its having been judged libelous, but asking Google to vanish from the searchable internet an article about a court decision, simply because one of the parties to the decision doesn't like the article, is absurd. My article did not endorse Fetzer's statements that the court found libelous. It did not assert, as Fetzer does, that nobody died at Sandy Hook. It merely noted procedural problems marring Fetzer's trial, arguing that the affair sets a dangerous precedent that could contribute to the ongoing rollback of free speech. My article is certainly not libelous, but if the charge is hyperbole, I plead guilty. Calling Fetzer's trial a lynching and a Stalinist-style show trial is obviously hyperbolic. Fetzer is not swinging at the end of a rope or lined up in front of a Bolshevik firing squad. I often use hyperbole to make a point, in this case, that the trial seemed unfair, and that free speech is in danger. Fortunately for us, opposite the editorial page writers, hyperbole isn't legally actionable. Reactions to my article were fairly evenly split between people who thought I didn't go far enough defending Fetzer on his thesis that Sandy Hook was a hoax, and others who thought Fetzer's interpretation is not just libelous but downright insane. Both sides wanted me to endorse their strongly held views on Sandy Hook. The most helpful feedback came from journalist Dave Gallery, publisher of Moon Rock Books. Gallery appeared on my radio show to explain how his viewpoint changed after he spent two full days with Posner. As the publisher of Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, Gallery had leaned toward viewing the event the way Fetzer does, as a FEMA stunt designed to promote gun control. But after watching Posner respond to questions at his deposition last spring, and conversing with him outside the formal setting, Gallery came to believe that Posner is telling the truth about losing his son, Noah. While still finding many aspects of Sandy Hook worthy of investigation, Gallery no longer accepts the thesis of the book, which he withdrew from circulation after his encounter with Posner. After our radio interview, Gallery sent an email urging me to look at the court transcript and documents archived at PosnerFetzer.com. Could all of the material Posner submitted to the court, notably the Zimmerman affidavits featuring abundant documentary evidence supporting Posner's account of the birth, life, and death of Noah Posner, really be fraudulent? The number of people and institutions that would have to be involved in such a hoax, and the seeming likelihood that it could be easily discovered, would seem to militate strongly against Fetzer's thesis. But if Posner is trying to debunk Sandy Hook conspiracy theories, the last thing he should be doing is urging Google to delist articles he disagrees with that discuss aspects of the case not related to Fetzer's claims. Anyone pushing censorship looks like he or she has something to hide. Google has already delisted many alternative news sites. Since purchasing YouTube, Google has purged the internet of tens of millions of videos. Between July and September 2019, Google obliterated 2 million YouTube channels and removed 7.85 million videos. In many cases, Google destroyed the livelihoods of the video makers simply because it didn't approve of their political views. Conservative voices have suffered the most. Google, Facebook, and Twitter have also been accused of shadow banning users on the basis of their political views. Shadow banning is an especially insidious form of censorship. According to The Economist, shadow banned users are not told that they have been affected. They can continue to post messages, add new followers, and comment on or reply to other posts, but their messages may not appear in the feed, their replies may be suppressed, and they may not show up in searches for their usernames. Such stealth censorship is an outrage. According to antitrust law, monopolies are illegal. The billionaire internet oligarchs censoring the digital public square are criminals and traitors to the Constitution. They should be arrested and their companies seized and run transparently as public utilities under First Amendment protections. Journalist arrested in Washington. Free speech hypocrisy abounds as left ignores mistreatment of newsman. By S.T. Patrick on October 25, Max Blumenthal, the editor of independent news website The Gray Zone and a frequent contributor to Consortium News, was arrested in Washington, D.C. It was a five-month-old arrest warrant levied in conjunction with a protest at the Venezuela embassy. Blumenthal had tried to bring food to the protesters inside the embassy, which had been under siege by protesters in Washington, D.C. police. For this, he was charged with simple assault. Blumenthal has been one of the leading voices in the alternative press, speaking out against the U.S.-backed coup d'etat that has brought the rise of Juan Guaido in Venezuela. Blumenthal was detained for 2 days and was not permitted to call an attorney for over 36 hours. He had been unaware that a warrant had been issued, believing it had initially been rejected, which it had, only to be revived later without Blumenthal's knowledge. A Guaido supporter, Nailet Pacheco, claims Blumenthal kicked her in the stomach in the middle of a chaotic scuffle between the opposing sides. If the government had at least told me I had a warrant, I could have voluntarily surrendered and appeared at my own arraignment, Blumenthal said. Instead, the federal government essentially enlisted the DC police to swat me. ensuring that I would be subjected to an early morning raid and then languish in prison for days without even the ability to call an attorney. In a statement shortly after his release, Blumenthal denied the charges and explained what he believes is the motivation for the warrant and arrest. This charge is a 100% false, fabricated, bogus, untrue, and malicious lie, Blumenthal said. It is clearly part of a campaign of political persecution designed to silence me in the gray zone for our factual journalism exposing the deceptions, corruption, and violence of the far right Venezuelan opposition. Blumenthal had been working on a series for the Gray Zone, exposing the direct U.S. intervention in the rise of Guaido. The Trump administration had always claimed that a grassroots uprising was occurring in what was once one of Latin America's richest oil-producing nations. The Trump administration rejected the election results of May 2018, in which Venezuelan voters re-elected President Nicolas Maduro. The U.S. was backing Guaido, a largely unknown Venezuelan figure. Polls showed that 80% of Venezuelans had never heard of him. In January, Guaido declared himself the president of Venezuela. The U.S. and 60 other puppet nations instantly recognized his ascendancy. The Department of State demanded all former Venezuelan diplomats leave the U.S. immediately. Those remaining at the Venezuelan embassy invited peace activists inside in order to protect their diplomatic home. In April, Guaido attempted to take Venezuela's presidential palace by force. In those moments, Guaido supporters also attempted to storm Venezuela's embassy in D.C. Attempts to starve out the original embassy employees were met with U.S. activists, who attempted to bring them food and supplies. Who or what is this opposition that is so financially and militarily supported by the U.S. and its interests? Alan McLeod of Mint Press News wrote, "Far from the wholesome image they enjoy in much of the press, the Venezuelan opposition has a long and exceptionally violent history of attacking political opponents, including journalists. Their many campaigns to oust President Maduro from power have included beheading innocent passersby and roasting Afro-Venezuelans alive in the street in an attempt to terrorize the population into surrender." The mainstream media and the non-governmental organizations, NGOs, that purport to protect journalists from governmental abuse have been silent on Blumenthal's arrest, just as they continue to poorly cover or fully ignore the plights of Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning. But Blumenthal was not the only high-profile figure who had attempted to bring food to the Venezuelans opposing U.S. intervention. Jesse Jackson Sr., former Green Party candidate Ejimu Baraka, Veterans for Peace President Gary Condon, and activist Ben Rubenstein had all been met with physical force when trying to feed those left inside. What else can we call it? We may disagree on its name, but unlike the New York Times, CNN, The Washington Post, and Reuters, we can't ignore it. To paraphrase theologian Martin Niemöller, first they came for Max Blumenthal. Part is an impeachment parade, really a deep state witch hunt. By Donald Jeffries. Evidence increasingly suggests that the recent campaign to impeach President Donald Trump is the culmination of joint efforts between members of the intelligence community and mainstream Democrats, which began upon his election. The much-beloved whistleblower, who had remained anonymous during fawning news coverage of his second and third-hand allegations, has now been identified as Eric Charamella, a CIA analyst specializing in Russian and Ukrainian affairs. Not surprisingly, Charamella is a registered Democrat. Not only that, he once worked directly for then-Vice President Joe Biden, who was intrinsically involved in the entire Ukrainian impeachment question, along with his son, Hunter. He also worked for former CIA Director John Brennan, one of many outspoken deep state critics of the president. In 2017, Trump's national security advisor H.R. McMaster appointed Charamella as his personal aide. Charamella had no direct knowledge of the infamous June 25 phone conversation that has formed the basis for the latest attempts to impeach Trump. It is known that Charamella contacted the staff of Rep. Adam Schiff, D. Califf, prior to filing his complaint. Interestingly, two of Charamella's former colleagues at the National Security Council have been hired by Schiff this year. To say that Charamella is a partisan opponent of Trump is to severely understate things. He worked with Ukrainian-American lawyer and activist Alexandra Chalupa in 2016 in an effort to find incriminating information about Trump. Chalupa, a former Democratic National Committee staffer, spent a great deal of time investigating Trump and his former campaign chairman Paul Manafort's alleged ties to Russia in the 2016 campaign. In a 2017 letter to Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, Senator Chuck Grassley, R. Iowa, charged, Chalupa's actions appear to show that she was simultaneously working on behalf of a foreign government, Ukraine, and on behalf of the DNC and Clinton campaign, in an effort to influence not only the U.S. voting population but U.S. government officials, far-left political commentary website Daily Kos, reflecting the massive divide in this country, countered with, Alexandra Chalupa is the Ukrainian American former DNC staffer who tried to alert the nation of the danger that was Paul Manafort before the 2016 election and was subsequently smeared by Republicans for her efforts. The question that should be asked here is, what was the personal aide to Trump's national security advisor doing working with a member of the opposition party to expose his alleged wrongdoing? In October 2016, before joining the Trump administration under McMaster, Chalupa was invited by Biden's office to a state luncheon for the Italian prime minister. Other attendees at this luncheon included Brennan, then FBI Director James Comey, and then National Intelligence Director James Clapper. According to investigative reporter Paul Sperry, several U.S. officials indicated that such an invitation to a relatively low-level GS-13 federal employee like Chalupa was highly unusual and especially given the known political sympathies of other notable guests, indicated that he may have had connections to the Obama White House. Chalupa reacted to the revelations of his connection to Biden and other powerful figures by expressing an unwillingness to testify before Schiff's committee. Additionally, according to the Washington Examiner, there is no discussion of testimony from a second whistleblower, who supported the first claims. There is no indication that either of the original whistleblowers will be called to testify or appear before the Senate or House Intelligence Committees. For those keeping score, pro-impeachment advocates are using as evidence the account of a whistleblower who actually was working with Trump's opponents while serving in his administration, has no first-hand knowledge of the Ukrainian phone call, and is now not even going to testify about it. Neither will his source. Donald Trump Jr. recently incurred the wrath of the gentle hosts of The View over his retweeting Chalupa's name as the whistleblower. The fact that his name had appeared in the media for several days before this mattered little to Joy Behr and company, and the mainstream media's recent love fest with this misnamed whistleblower didn't translate into any positive coverage for Ashley Bianco, recently fired by CBS for exposing the suppression by network competitor ABC of a story regarding Jeffrey Epstein. As the Wall Street Journal noted, since the CIA employee came forward and was trumpeted as a courageous whistleblower, CBS had aired more than 100 stories on Trump and Ukraine. Needless to say, those stories left little doubt in the minds of viewers that the network takes these laughable allegations seriously as impeachable offenses. As Fox Business reported, you don't need to take seriously anymore when ABC and CBS did another story worshipping the alleged federal whistleblower, pretending that there's some sacred right to remain anonymous while criticizing the president, because we're seeing how they treat a whistleblower in their midst. All whistleblowers clearly aren't equal. The Deep State versus General Michael Flynn, by Donald Jeffries Lieutenant. General Michael Flynn stood out from all the rest of Donald Trump's putrid, longtime insider appointments to his cabinet. Flynn seemed to be the closest thing to an outsider in the Trump administration. Predictably, he was targeted for removal before he'd even begun his extraordinarily brief tenure as National Security Advisor. The establishment was alarmed with Trump's selection of Flynn, and immediately the state-controlled media went into overdrive in an attempt to derail the choice. Flynn attended a December 2015 10th anniversary gala for RT, formerly Russia Today, the Russian-owned English-language media outlet, which provides more independent investigative reporting than all the American television networks combined. They are the only television network to ever ask this author to appear on air. Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein was also at this anniversary celebration but didn't face quite the same critical scrutiny. In early 2017, several Democratic congressmen formally requested that Secretary of Defense James Mattis investigate Flynn's connections to RT, the same American intelligence community that has been at loggerheads with Donald Trump since he first entered the White House, characterized RT as the Kremlin's principal international propaganda outlet. Ironically, Flynn notably said during a fiery speech at the 2016 Republican convention, regarding Hillary Clinton, "If I did a tenth of what she did, I'd be in jail today." Flynn would go on to be blasted for several controversial retweets on Twitter and accused of anti-Semitism and promoting conspiracy theories like Pizzagate. Like Trump himself, Flynn incurred the wrath of the deep state with his contention that Obama's reliance on deadly drones was a failed strategy and called our disastrous bipartisan foreign policy this continued investment in conflict. "The more weapons we give, the more bombs we drop. That just fuels the conflict." Establishment vitriol toward Flynn extended to his son, Michael G. Flynn, who was known for his extreme tweets about Hillary Clinton's corruption and other verboten subjects. He became the target of his own federal investigation into possible collusion between Trump and Russia, and alleged Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. The younger Flynn was renowned for his politically incorrect tweets, as well, and mention other conspiratorial topics like an alleged video of Bill Clinton raping a teenage girl. Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio's rumored secret gay lifestyle, and frequently retweeted Paul Joseph Watson, longtime associate of Alex Jones. In 2017, Flynn pled guilty, almost certainly under the threat of more punitive punishment, to lying to government investigators about conversations he'd had with a Russian ambassador in late 2016. In the aftermath of the deal, Flynn fired his defense team, and his new attorney Sidney Powell stated, "There never would have been a plea to begin with if Flynn had been aware of the amount of information being withheld from him." In early November, federal prosecutors rejected what they termed an extraordinary reversal by Flynn, who is now claiming he was the victim of a plot to set up an innocent man and create a crime. In a recent court filing, the prosecutors noted that Flynn now claims that he is innocent of the criminal charge in this case, and, for the first time, the defendant represents to this court that he was honest with the agents. On January 24, 2017, to the best of his recollection at the time, he makes this claim despite having admitted his guilt, under oath, before two federal judges, including this court. Among the evidence, Attorney Powell is requesting U.S. District Court Judge Emmett Sullivan release her two BlackBerry devices used by the shadowy Maltese professor Joseph Mifsud, who has been placed at the center of the entire Russian collusion fantasy. Flynn's lawyers also allege that James Comey's FBI engaged in massive misrepresentation, leading him to believe the agents were interested in a friendly conversation about terrorism. Powell told Sullivan the interview was an ambush, and said, "When the director of the FBI, and a group of his close associates, plot to set up an innocent man and create a crime, while taking affirmative steps to ensnare him by refusing to follow procedures designed to prevent such inadvertent missteps, this amounts to conduct so shocking to the conscience and so inimical to our system of justice that it requires the dismissal of the charges for outrageous government conduct." Flynn, like Paul Manafort and Roger Stone, are surrogate scapegoats for Donald Trump and the entire Russian collusion narrative. Today's so-called liberals devise nicknames like Moscow Mitch and Red Rand for Republicans, without the slightest evidence or realization of how closely this all mirrors the age of McCarthyism which they seemingly abhor. While the deep state tries to convert a nebulous phone conversation into an impeachable offense, the Bushes, the Clintons, and the rest of the odious swamp remain free. Trump's high crimes non-existent, the president's broke no laws, so there can be no impeachment. By Patrick J. Buchanan, treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors, these are the offenses designated in the Constitution for which presidents may be impeached and removed from office. Which of these did President Donald Trump commit? According to his accusers in this city, his crime is as follows: the president imperiled our national security by delaying, for his own reasons, a transfer of lethal-laden Javelin missiles to Ukraine, the very weapons President Barack Obama refused to send to Ukraine, lest they widen and lengthen the war in the Donbass. Now, if Trump imperiled national security by delaying the transfer of the weapons, was not Obama guilty of a greater crime against our national security by denying the weapons to Ukraine altogether? The essence of Trump's crime, it is said, was that he demanded a quid pro quo. He passed word to incoming President Volodymyr Zelensky that if he did not hold a press conference to announce an investigation of Joe Biden and son Hunter, he, Zelensky, would not get the arms we had promised, nor the Oval Office meeting that Zelensky requested. Again, where is the body of the crime? Did Zelensky hold the press conference Trump demanded? No. Did Zelensky announce Ukraine was investigating the Bidens? No. Did Zelensky get the Oval Office meeting? Yes. Did Zelensky get the U.S. weapons? Yes, for $100 million in arms and Javelin missiles. Where then is the crime? When was it consummated? Or was this a thought crime, a bluff to get Zelensky to look into how Hunter Biden got a $50,000 a month seat on the board of the most corrupt company in Ukraine? Days after Joe Biden was in Kiev threatening to block a $1 billion loan guarantee to the regime. By the way, what was Biden doing approving a $1 billion loan guarantee to Petro Poroshenko's regime, which was so corrupt that it ferociously fought not to fire a prosecutor whose dismissal all of Europe was demanding? Should Biden be nominated and elected, a special prosecutor would have to be appointed to investigate this smelly deal, as well as the $1 billion Hunter got for his equity fund from the Chinese after his father visited the Middle Kingdom. Given last week's party line vote in the House, where all but two Democrats voted to proceed with the inquiry, the impeachment of Trump seems baked in the cake. Speaker Nancy Pelosi's designation of Rep. Adam Schiff, D.Califf, to head the investigation tells us all we need to know about the sincerity of her pledge to make the inquiry bipartisan. Suppose Zelensky had agreed to an investigation into how Hunter Biden, with no experience in the energy industry, got a sweetheart deal. Would that be impeachable for Trump? How so? Does not the U.S. have a right to put conditions on its foreign aid and to seek guarantees that our money will not be used as graft to grifters? A few of those listening in on Trump's phone call with Zelensky have gone public asserting that withholding the arms transfer to Kiev imperiled our national security. But if East Ukraine rises up and secedes from Kiev, as Kiev itself seceded from the Russian Federation at the end of the Cold War, how does any of that endanger America's national security? Did not President George H.W. Bush himself warn, 3 decades ago, that a declaration of independence by Ukraine from the Russian Federation would constitute an act of suicidal nationalism? And who does the Constitution charge with making the decisions as to whether military aid goes to Ukraine? The President, or some National Security Council, NSC, staffer who sits on the Ukraine desk? Since the U.S. backed overthrow of the pro-Russian regime in Kiev in 2014, and Vladimir Putin's counter-seizure of Crimea and support for pro-Russian secessionists in Donetsk and Luhansk, there has been a debate in the United States over how to deal with this faraway problem. Obama decided not to send lethal-laden or tank-killing Javelin missiles, lest the U.S. arms escalate a war between Russia and Ukraine that Kiev could not win. The Republicans argued the issue at their Cleveland convention. Trump's team won that argument, but lethal-laden Javelin missiles were eventually sent to Kiev. Now Trump has sent even more weapons. But again, the authority to make this decision resides in the Oval Office, not in the NSC, not in the CIA, and not with those in the deep state who have their own settled view of what U.S. foreign policy should be. The authority lies with the elected President of the United States. This impeachment battle will almost surely reach the Senate, and in the end, it will be about what it has been about since the beginning, an attempt by the deep state and its media, bureaucratic, and political allies to overturn the Democratic verdict of 2016 and to overthrow the elected President of the United States. The establishment's coup attempt is now approaching endgame. The Syria ISIS fraud exposed alleged assassination of terrorist leader took place in area protected by U.S. by St. Patrick as American militarists continue to rejoice in the killing of self-proclaimed ISIS Caliph Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. They are forced to reckon with a strategy they, themselves, used to create a safe haven for Al-Qaeda and ISIS in Idlib, the northwestern Syrian province where Baghdadi was protected and then killed. There are moral, ethical, and strategic conundrums the American military faces in Syria, a majority of which are caused by the dense logic and passion toward interventionism that keeps them there today. Idlib is a Syrian war zone located, metaphorically, somewhere between hell and Detroit. While it is as dangerous as any region in the world, the American military has held a shaky control over the Idlib province and its 165,000 people. On the one hand, American regime change supporters have been very attentive toward Idlib. It is the last powerful bastion of Syrian opposition to the government of President Bashar al-Assad. On the other hand, it is the home of the largest conglomeration of al-Qaeda fighters in the world. Syria's largest al-Qaeda affiliate, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, controls the province on the ground and in the minds of its residents, while the Americans control it from the sky, from the borders, from the defense contractors, from CIA headquarters, and, if you believe the narrative streaming out of Washington, D.C., from a technologically advanced situation room in the White House. The State Department and the Pentagon are not hiding the fact that they are actively supporting the largest global collection of al-Qaeda fighters. In fact, they are admitting what would, to many, be a great post-9/11 hypocrisy, while furthermore bragging about its size. In June, Deputy Secretary for the Middle East Michael P. Mulroy said, "Idlib is essentially the largest collection of al-Qaeda affiliates in the world right now." General Joseph Dunford, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, confirmed that there are between 20,000 and 30,000 fighters in Idlib. Al-Qaeda makes up a majority of those being armed by the American military on the ground. The other large faction had been called the Free Syria Army. The American people were propagandized to believe these were average Syrian-stern rebels. Horrified by the brutality of Assad and inspired by the American support to pick up arms in defense of their homeland. In October, the truth reared an even uglier head than the ongoing civil war, when President Donald Trump recently decided to accept a Turkish invasion of Syria. The world discovered the identities of the moderate rebels. All it took for the curtain to be pulled back was for President Donald Trump to greenlight a Turkish invasion of Syria, Dan Cohen of news website The Gray Zone wrote. Those once moderate CIA-trained Contras who had long terrorized civilians in Syrian government territory were revealed to be Turkish-backed mercenaries, slaughtering and beheading their way throughout the Kurdish-majority regions of northeastern Syria. Not only are the Americans fighting in Syria alongside those al-Qaeda forces whom they continue firing upon in Afghanistan and Iraq today, but they have now unleashed their mercenary Turkish allies on the Kurds, whom the George H.W. Bush administration had instructed us were the sympathetic Iraqis during Operation Desert Storm. Syria has been a complex story to follow, part of what has made many Americans tune out, but to understand what has happened, one needs to just remember the axiom, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. In deciding that Assad is public enemy number one in Syria, the Americans have turned the largest region they still control into a jihadist haven for al-Qaeda fighters and Turkish mercenaries willing to fight against Assad. In doing so, they created a safe zone for Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and ISIS leader al-Baghdadi. Almost instantly after the killing of al-Baghdadi was publicized, Democratic presidential candidate Rep. Tulsi Gabbard, D. Hawaii, criticized Trump for supporting al-Qaeda by prioritizing the defense of Idlib. Senator Kamala Harris, D. Calif., whose campaign is now on life support, attacked Gabbard for being an apologist for an individual, Assad, who has murdered people in his country like cockroaches. Gabbard's comments, however, are supported by Brett McGurk, the former special presidential envoy for the Global Coalition to Counter ISIS, who said in July 2017 that Idlib province is the largest al-Qaeda safe haven since 9/11. The Middle East think tanks and Washington journalistic set feigned surprise and astonishment that al-Baghdadi had been hiding in Idlib. The morning the assassination of al-Baghdadi was announced, in that moment of analytical insanity, Max Abrams of Northeastern University provided one of the few sane analyses of the situation. The think tank crowd gets an F for ISIS and Syria analysis, Abrams said. These same pundits who got the main points about ISIS and Syria so obviously wrong are now shocked that Baghdadi was hiding in Idlib, the opposition stronghold. This is because they have been arguing since day one that ISIS is not part of the opposition to Assad, but rather his ally, and they have been trying to minimize the portion of the opposition seen as extreme. For those of us who understood that ISIS and Assad are not friends and that the rebels have been al-Qaeda tainted for some time, it's no surprise that the ISIS leader would set up shop in the heart of the opposition, where al-Qaeda and friends are the dominant groups. Why did al-Baghdadi go to Idlib, a place defended by American weaponry and CIA-trained fighters? It was the perfect place for him to recruit jihadists and build the caliphate. Why did the Americans kill one of the major organizers of the Assad opposition? Because Trump may have, once again, shot himself in the foot. He chose the short-term, Obama-like death of Osama bin Laden campaign season victory parade, Situation Room shock photo included, over the narrative that had been built since the April 2017 missile strike on the Shayrat Air Base. In doing so, the narrative of the regime changers, and thus the Pentagon and the CIA, has been thoroughly exposed. Leftist policies are ruining Europe if suicidal immigration policies are not reversed. Christian European culture will die. By Dr. Paul Craig Robertson. Sweden. The rape of white Swedish women by black immigrants invaders never stops. In the latest outrage, four black Eritreans forced a 13-year-old Swedish girl into a bathroom and took turns raping her while filming the gang rape. According to the news report, the rape was preceded by violence consisting of at least two of the defendants grabbing the plaintiff's neck and shoulder, slamming her head into a wall and pushing her into a bathroom. If convicted, prosecutors hope that the four blacks are deported back to Eritrea and are banned from entering Sweden for at least 15 years. But the Swedish Migration Tribunal blocks deportations on humanitarian grounds. Deportation means no prison time for gang raping and recording the rape, which under Swedish law is a clear felony as a child pornography offense. Prison time would be too much to impose on the poor, underprivileged, misunderstood black men from Eritrea who came to Sweden searching for a new life. I can hear the feminist Swedish government crying over the poor dears and blaming the Swedish girl for the rape. Notice also that the news report describes the gang rapists as defendants and not as perpetrators, and that the raped victim is merely a plaintiff, not a victim. This is the way it is in Sweden. The migrant invader rapist bomb throwers are protected by hate speech laws. A raped Swedish woman runs a risk of being accused of a hate crime by immigrant invader advocates if she reports her rape. Police officials, who have stated that the vast majority of rapes are committed by the immigrant invaders, have been suspended and investigated. Why do white women continue to live in Sweden, a country where the feminist government dangles them as bait to attract more immigrant invaders? Polls show that 25% of Swedish women are afraid to leave their house even to go shopping. The 1,472% increase in violent rape has left Swedish women prisoners in their own homes. Does the 13-year-old girl have a father, brothers, or cousins? If so, how can the prosecutors expect the blacks to live long enough to be deported to Eritrea? As the traitors all-female government of Sweden has opened Sweden's borders and invited in rapists of Swedish women, there is no government protection of Swedish women. Punishment of rapists has collapsed. The Norwegian-based Herland report reports that in an astounding number of cases, the Swedish courts have demonstrated sympathy for the rapists, and have acquitted suspects who have claimed that the girl wanted to have sex with six, seven, or eight men. Wherever we look in Europe, the same question stares us in the face. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has destroyed Germany. The German Federal Institute for Employment Research estimates that immigrant invaders could constitute more than 40% of the population of Germany in 20 years. In larger cities, the migrant invader population is expected to comprise 70% of the population. In other words, Merkel has left no room for Germans in German cities. European alt-media news reports say that Italy gives more aid to immigrant invaders than it does to the Italian handicapped. We see this everywhere. Europe exists for the immigrant invaders, not for the native-born citizens. The leader of France's nationalist party, Marine Le Pen is threatened with criminal prosecution for hate speech for defending the rights of Frenchmen. Nowhere in Europe can a citizen protest the destruction of his country without being called a white supremacist and subject to indictment for hate speech. Nationalism and patriotism have become crimes. To be clear, Europe is a Tower of Babel, an utterly destroyed civilization. There is no Europe left. It is the same in the United States. President Barack Obama, the great savior, dumped 100,000 Somalis on Minneapolis and another 100,000 on Portland, Maine, and little doubt elsewhere. What does a community do when it has 100,000 aliens dumped in its midst demanding food, housing, health care, and entertainment? Being dark-skinned, the unwanted immigrants have privileges under the civil rights laws that discriminate against white men. How does it help Washington to have Europe under the control of Islamicists that Washington has been bombing and invading for two decades? How does it help the Israelis to have the Islamist Middle East spread into Europe? How does it help Israel to have vast numbers of Islamicists in the U.S. to object to Israel's control over the U.S. government and Israel's territorial gains in the Middle East? Clearly, the morons who rule in Washington and Israel have created a world that is multiplying the numbers and power of the enemies of Israel in Washington. Little wonder Russia and China stand aside ignoring provocations and waiting for the certain self-destruction of the utterly dumb Western world. Is NATO brain dead? Divides between member states is growing larger. By Richard Walker after 70 years, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, has gone into steady decline. While its supporters, to quote Mark Twain, will insist that its death has been greatly exaggerated, the cracks in its core have been growing deeper. French President Emmanuel Macron, the most outspoken European leader on the issue, is now claiming that NATO is brain dead, added dwindling support from Washington. His views appear to echo a previous remark by President Donald Trump that NATO was obsolete, but that did not entirely reflect the president's opinion, because he also said that the alliance was very important to him. The conflicting nature of all these assertions has only added to a general feeling that NATO is no longer as relevant as it once was. According to Macron, it could soon vanish. There is no disputing that it has departed from its original mission to protect Europe from the Soviet Union. The disintegration of the Soviet Empire, and the growing closeness of Washington and Moscow, has led many observers to conclude that since Russia no longer poses an imminent threat of the kind once clearly apparent in Soviet political and military posturing, NATO is indeed a relic of the past. A rarely discussed aspect of the debate about the fast-changing nature of NATO is the failure of many of its backers to recognize that its demise accelerated under the Barack Obama presidency. That might seem contradictory, given President Obama's praise of the alliance and his dependence on it. But the fact remains that he exploited NATO's military capability and expanded its reach well beyond Europe, much to the organization's detriment. He also allowed Israel to engage with NATO exercises and toyed with the prospect of backing an Israeli request for membership. The starkest examples of how he damaged the NATO brand can be found in his willingness to enable French President Nicolas Sarkozy and British Prime Minister David Cameron to push for the overthrow of Libyan leader Khalil Muammar Gaddafi. It has since transpired that Sarkozy had corrupt links to Gaddafi and may have wanted to get rid of him to hide financial ties to him. France also wanted Libya's oil. Obama later blamed his two allies for the war in Libya and the mess that has followed. But that was disingenuous. After all, Obama was in overall charge of the NATO forces that overthrew the Libyan government. Libya was not the end of NATO's foreign adventurism. Obama dragged the alliance into the war in Syria, once again with the French and British, as well as NATO member Turkey. Help in the shadows came from Israel and Saudi Arabia. NATO helped train and arm the terrorist and guerrilla forces amassed to fight Syria's government led by Bashar al-Assad, including Kurds and extreme Islamic elements such as the al-Nusra Front. It was heavily involved in the arming and training of the anti-Assad forces, routing large weapons consignments through the Balkans to northern Iraq where they were distributed to Kurdish fighters. It also quietly encouraged Turkey to train anti-Assad militias, many of them dominated by ISIS fighters. A critical result of the wars in Libya and Syria was a massive flow of migrants into Europe. So, While NATO was an alliance designed to protect Europe from exterior threats, it chose instead to create conditions that facilitated a mass migrant movement that became a threat to Europe's internal stability. A real body blow to NATO cohesion arose from the 2016 failed coup against Turkey's President Recep Erdogan, who said the attempt to dethrone him was approved by Obama and European NATO members, specifically Germany. Moscow exploited Erdogan's subsequent anti-Western feelings and benefited from the fact that the Russians had also saved Erdogan's presidency by giving him ample warning of the plot against him. Since then, however, Trump has developed closer ties to Moscow and Erdogan and has refused to oppose Turkey's decision to purchase the Russian S-400 missile system over its U.S. NATO counterpart, the Patriot missile system. By all accounts, Turkey no longer appears to be a committed NATO member, further shattering the alliance's claim to unity. It has instead drawn closer to its neighbor, Russia. A further sign of NATO weakness has been its reduced funding over decades, due to the unfair reliance of its members on Washington's dollars. The effects of this were evident in 2018 during the NATO military exercises, Trident Juncture. They paled in comparison to massive exercises held by Russia, illustrating that NATO was no match for Russia in a conventional war. It was equally embarrassing for NATO that Russia managed to disrupt the NATO exercises by using electronic warfare devices to target them. NATO now finds itself divided into blocs, with the most vocal being those nations like Poland bordering Russia who argue that the threat to Europe comes from the east. In contrast, Trump wants NATO to focus solely on terrorism and illegal immigration. Other NATO members, especially Germany and France, favor the creation of a European Defense Force to replace NATO, thereby signaling that they have already envisioned the death of the alliance. It is unlikely Britain would join any NATO replacement force. What demonstrates that NATO is far from dead, however, is that there are more U.S. forces in Europe than there were during the Obama years, and Trump is committed to placing more troops in frontline Baltic states. Mother of all bubbles about to burst, busting of sovereign debt bubble will cause a crash worse than the 2008 meltdown. By Dr. Ron Paul. When the New York Federal Reserve began pumping billions of dollars a day into the repurchasing, repo, markets, the market banks used to make short-term loans to each other, in September, they said this would only be necessary for a few weeks. Yet, last Wednesday, almost 2 months after the Fed's initial intervention, the New York Federal Reserve pumped $62.5 billion into the repo market. The New York Fed continues these emergency interventions to ensure cash shortages among banks don't ever again cause interest rates for overnight loans to rise to over 10%, well above the Fed's target rate. The Federal Reserve's bailout operations have increased its balance sheet by over $200 billion since September. Investment advisor Michael Pento describes the Fed's recent actions as quantitative easing, QE, on steroids. One cause of the repo market's sudden cash shortage was the large amount of debt instruments issued by the Treasury Department in late summer and early fall. Banks used resources they would normally devote to private sector lending and overnight loans to purchase these Treasury securities. This scenario will likely keep recurring as the Treasury Department will have to continue issuing new debt instruments to finance continuing increases in government spending. Even though the federal deficit is already over $1 trillion and growing, President Donald Trump and Congress have no interest in cutting spending, especially in an election year. Should he win re-election, Trump is unlikely to reverse course and champion fiscal restraint. Instead, he will likely take his victory as a sign that the people support big federal budgets and huge deficits. None of the leading Democratic candidates are even pretending to care about the deficit. Instead, they are proposing increasing spending by trillions on new government programs. Joseph Zittel, a strategist with the Blackstone investment firm, has called the government, or sovereign, debt bubble the mother of all bubbles. When the sovereign debt bubble inevitably busts, it will cause a meltdown bigger than the 2008 crash. U.S. consumer debt, which includes credit cards, student loans, auto loans, and mortgages, now totals over $14 trillion. This massive government and private debts put tremendous pressure on the Federal Reserve to keep interest rates low or even to experiment with negative rates. But the Fed can only keep interest rates, which are the price of money, artificially low for so long without serious economic consequences. According to Pento, the Fed is panicking in an effort to prevent economic trouble much worse than occurred in 2008. It's not just QE, says Pento. It's QE on steroids because everybody knows that this QE is permanent, just like any banana republic would or has done in the past. Congress will not cut spending until either a critical mass of Americans demand they do so, or there is a major economic crisis. In the event of a crisis, Congress will try to avoid directly cutting spending, instead letting the Federal Reserve do its dirty work via currency depreciation. This will deepen the crisis and increase support for authoritarian demagogues. The only way to avoid this is for those of us who know the truth to spread the message of, and grow the movement for, peace, free markets, limited government, and sound money. JFK assassination researchers are fractured, unproductive, by Donald Jeffries every November for decades. A good number of researchers into the assassination of President John F. Kennedy gather in Dallas. There are always a number of speakers, addressing various aspects of the crime. These conferences also occur in other parts of the country, and even in the United Kingdom and Australia. John Barber, who like this author has been absolutely ignored by those who organize and promote these conferences, recently wrote on Facebook, "Pardon me if this upsets anyone, but I do not understand why anyone would either put on another JFK conference, speak at one or attend one. Every November 22nd should be America's Bastille Day, with the thousands involved with these events are signing useless petitions to Congress instead gathering at the Robert F. Kennedy Justice Department." Barber should reasonably be seen as the face of the research community at this point, given his work with Jim Garrison and his impressive show business pedigree. From the beginning, when citizen critics of the Warren Report like Mark Lane and Harold Weisberg began publishing works that demolished the official story, there was bickering and envy between the large egos and difficult personalities that have always been the predominant researchers in the case. Lane and Weisberg despised each other. Weisberg, especially, was jealous of all the others and regularly panned their work. When Oliver Stone's JFK was released in 1991, Weisberg carried the enmity many critics felt toward the director, making Garrison his protagonist to an absurd extreme, leaking an advance copy of the film's script to a CIA friendly asset at the Washington Post. Weisberg, like most of the other leading critics, wanted to be portrayed as the hero in the movie. Garrison's investigation split the critical community, with even the best of them, like former World Health Organization employee Sylvia Meager, turning against the New Orleans district attorney. When Michael Collins Piper, longtime writer for American Free Press and its predecessor, The Spotlight, published Final Judgment, The Missing Link in the JFK Assassination Conspiracy in 1993, it was ignored or ridiculed by the research community. The predictable charges of anti-Semitism were leveled against him. Recently, on one of the larger JFK assassination forums, this author responded to a thread revolving around JFK's battles with David Ben-Gurion and Israel's burgeoning nuclear program by noting that credit should be given to Piper, whose research first shed light upon this area. Unsurprisingly, those posting ignored that, and continue to deny Piper the credit he deserves. The lack of cohesion in the critical community, with the continuous internal arguments among researchers, has played into the hands of the state-controlled media, which has always sought to paint those who doubt the Warren Report as eccentric wackos. Critics routinely dismiss each other as disinformation agents and limited hangout dupes of one intelligence agency or another. In 2013, this author attempted to bring researchers together by writing the following consensus statement: "The Warren Commission, FBI, and Dallas police did not solve the mystery of who assassinated President John F. Kennedy on November 22, 1963. The House Assassinations Committee of the late 1970s left more questions than answers behind them. Despite the fact a real investigation has never been conducted, the available evidence shows conclusively that Lee Harvey Oswald was not the assassin and was framed by others for the crime. On the verge of the 50th anniversary of the most significant political assassination of the 20th century, it is more important than ever for there to be an open and independent inquiry into the matter for the very first time. It was published on the largest JFK assassination forum, Spartacus, out of London. The responses generated to this consensus statement illustrated the problem. Very few researchers would agree to it, and most wanted to battle over a word or a perceived inference. The long discussion that ensued developed into something akin to Bill Clinton's memorable, "It depends on what the meaning of is." It is difficult for those who have devoted decades to researching the assassination, as this author has, to accept a level of dysfunction among those who share the same intense interest in the subject. Heated battles over things like body alteration, film alteration, and Judith Vere Baker, the woman who claims to have been Lee Harvey Oswald's lover, occupy most of the critical community's attention, and form the basis for the speakers invited and subjects explored at all the research conferences. This author's writing has received little to no support from the vast majority of JFK assassination researchers, many of them longtime cyber friends. Lone utters don't argue with each other about anything. The same can't be said for those who are awake to the truth that a conspiracy took the life of JFK. Something not right with CA Wildfire's longtime firefighter says something else besides global warming at play here. By Mark Anderson, recently retired fire captain, Matt Aiken does not hesitate when he insists that the wildfires that have been raging and ruining California are, for the most part, not conventional fires at all. Daken served in the San Ramon Valley Fire Protection District and several other fire units for over 30 years. At an absolute minimum, he said, the authorities have been standing down in some instances, thereby allowing the fires to worsen and spread unprecedented destruction and death. Known cloud seeding technologies that could have been applied to bring rain in time to dampen the fires have been completely ignored, he told AFP for an exclusive. They had Operation Porpoise, now declassified, way back in Vietnam, seeding the clouds with special flares to make it rain on the Ho Chi Minh Trail to slow down North Vietnam's military advances, Daken told his writer. This writer had confirmed that fact at a December 2016 Freedom Force International Conference in Arizona that included talks on weather modification and weaponization. Another bizarre circumstance in California came about when the most recent Kincade Fire, as it's known, came within a mile or so of Daken's Sonoma County home amid warnings of high winds, the infamous Santa Ana winds, coming to the area in a couple days, a situation that should have prompted authorities to seize the window of opportunity ahead of the coming winds and fight the fire to keep it from spreading. But that crucial advance firefighting never happened, said Daken, who on October 25 could see the fires over a ridge, with a smell of smoke worsening by the moment. A news crew was prevented from entering the area in their van, which I feel happened to prevent them from seeing that the fire was not being fought while there was still time, Daken said. Daken noted other strange phenomena related to these fires. The Tubbs Fire of 2017 in Sonoma County reduced virtually every house to its foundation with only powder remaining throughout, yet the surrounding trees remained largely intact and green and household appliances weren't left a hollowed-out metal shell, as is often the case in a conventional fire. Rather, the appliances were completely gone. Every house was destroyed to the same degree and in the same manner. The same fire somehow jumped 6-lane Highway 101 and burned other neighborhoods as well while completely destroying a fully sprinkled Kmart. Daken added that such buildings, with their concrete tilt-up construction design, are built so they don't just burn up. In the 2018 Camp Fire that totally destroyed the city of Paradise in Butte County, which with unprecedented speed and fury killed at least 86 people and destroyed some 19,000 structures, 14,000 of which were homes, various trees and manzanita bushes appeared to have burned from the inside out, even including individual trees that were isolated in asphalt parking lots away from the main fires. Oftentimes, the strange internal fires would start at the bottom, seemingly from the inside of the roots. One of the things that worries me the most is the weaponization of the weather, but nobody talks about it, Daken said, adding that apparent aerosol injections in the atmosphere, resulting in what many call chemtrails, need to be further investigated just as alleged clandestine weather alteration needs to be further probed. I'm speculating, but this stuff points to a lot of good information I have, Dakin said of these possible causes, while adding that the normal hydrological cycle is interrupted via atmospheric spraying, which completely dries everything out and turns it into a tinderbox, and then they blame it on climate change. It's maddening, he said. Feds finally start jailing neo-Bolshevik terrorists. By John Friend on November 1, a violent Antifa extremist was sentenced to 6 years in prison for striking another man in the head with a baton during a protest in Portland, or in June of this year. Protests in Portland in recent years have seen shocking levels of political violence, largely committed by radical left-wing extremists and members of Antifa, who often use masks to conceal their identity and violently assault their perceived political opponents without provocation. Gage Halapowski, 24, struck Adam Kelly, a conservative activist, in the head during the June protest, causing Kelly to require 25 staples to close the gash on his head. The violent blow, which was caught on film and used as evidence in the trial, also caused Kelly to sustain a concussion. The incident took place during the same protest where independent journalist Andy Ngo was violently attacked, which caused Ngo to sustain serious injuries including a brain bleed. Several other conservative or right-leaning protesters were also assaulted by Antifa members during the protest. Yet thus far only Halapowski has been brought to justice. Prosecutor Melissa Marrero argued that Halapowski's attack on Kelly was completely unexplainable, completely avoidable, and didn't need to happen. According to the Epoch Times, Marrero indicated her office is continuing to investigate the violence that occurred the day, including others who participated in the attack against Kelly. My office has individuals charged on both sides of the political spectrum, Marrero stated. We are not picking sides based on political affiliation, political views, or anything like that. The sentencing of Halapowski comes roughly 1 month after the successful conviction of yet another far-left extremist named David Campbell, 32, who pleaded guilty to 2 counts of felony assault last month. Campbell will serve 18 months in prison for assaulting a 56-year-old Trump supporter in January 2018. Campbell was arrested after reportedly punching the Trump supporter in the head after attending an event in New York City celebrating the anniversary of Donald Trump's inauguration organized by political commentator Mike Cernovich. Following the assault, NYPD officers arrested and charged Campbell with multiple crimes, including strangulation, assault, criminal possession of a weapon, assault of a police officer, resisting arrest, and other related charges. The additional charges were dropped during the trial. Ngo was recently interviewed on Fox News about the recent convictions of the two radical leftists. Incredibly, despite video and photographic evidence, credible testimony, and other evidence, the vast majority of left-wing activists who have engaged in political violence have not been prosecuted, leading many to conclude that certain elements in law enforcement and political establishment have coddled Antifa extremists while pursuing right-leaning activists with the full force of the justice system. I want to point out that this is only the second violent Antifa criminal across the United States to face actual prison time, Ngo stated to Fox News. The first one was a militant in New York City. Just last month he was sentenced to 18 months. So I hope that this marks a new trend in prosecutors pushing for actual convictions and sentencing. Last month, a Manhattan judge sentenced 2 members of the Proud Boys, a much maligned pro-Western men's fraternal organization founded by the right-leaning political dissident and activist Gavin McGinnis, to 4-year prison sentences for their participation in a brawl with radical left-wing extremists. Following a speech by McGinnis at the Metropolitan Republican Club in New York roughly 1 year ago, Maxwell Hare, 27, and John Kinsman, 40, were convicted of attempted gang assault, and rioting this past August for their actions on the evening of October 12, 2018. Hare and Kinsman were with a group of other Proud Boys and supporters of McGinnis who were exiting the Metropolitan Republican Club following McGinnis's speech as radical left-wing extremists, who were protesting the event, eagerly awaited to unleash mayhem. According to local reports, roughly 60 Antifa-affiliated protesters jeered and physically confronted the Proud Boys and other attendees of the speech during their exit from the building. Police attempted to direct the attendees around the radical left-wing protesters. However, several Antifa members then attacked a group of the Proud Boys, including Haron Kinsman. A violent scuffle ensued as fights broke out and punches were thrown, faux conservatives being challenged by John Friend. A burgeoning movement on the dissident right comprised of America First nationalists concerned with immigration, changing demographics, disastrous foreign entanglements, and globalism are on a mission to publicly confront, challenge, and expose the mainstream conservative establishment epitomized by figures such as Charlie Kirk of Turning Points USA, TPUSA, and Ben Shapiro of The Daily Wire, among others. The America First movement, led primarily by Nick Fuentes, a 21-year-old rising political commentator and host of America First, a popular nightly political analysis program on YouTube, has gained steam in recent weeks as supporters of the movement have publicly confronted Kirk and others associated with conservative incorporated at public events across the country. Kirk is wrapping up the TPUSA-sponsored culture war tour, which brought the young conservative speaker and political organizer to various college campuses for public events that also featured open question and answer sessions. Throughout the tour, Kirk invited other mainstream conservative figures on stage with him, and also helped organize similar events not officially part of the culture war tour, including a recent book signing event at UCLA featuring Donald Trump Jr. and Kimberly Guilfoyle, a former prosecutor and Fox News commentator that now serves as a senior advisor on the Trump presidential campaign. Other campus conservative groups, such as Young America's Foundation and various college Republican organizations, have also organized public events in recent weeks that have been attended by supporters of the America First movement. Fuentes and his followers have used the Q&A sessions at these events to publicly challenge the conservative credentials of Kirk and others on stage with him, pressing the representatives of Conservative Incorporated on issues relating to massive immigration, both legal and illegal, unwavering support for Israel, and related matters. Questioners have even broached taboo topics such as Israel's brutal assault on the USS Liberty in 1967, Israeli espionage against the U.S., and various cultural issues such as Conservative Incorporated's seeming support and acceptance of the mainstreaming of homosexuality. This reporter attended the aforementioned book signing event at UCLA, organized by TPUSA's UCLA chapter. The event was designed to promote Donald Trump Jr.'s recently published book Triggered, How the Left Thrives on Hate and Wants to Silence Us All, with an open discussion followed by a book signing. Originally scheduled as a two-hour event, Kirk, Trump Jr., and Guilfoyle were forced to flee the stage after only 30 minutes due to boos and dissatisfaction from the audience, who were not allowed to ask questions or engage the speakers. Just prior to the speakers taking the stage, a representative from TPUSA's UCLA chapter announced that a Q&A session would not be allowed due to time constraints. The announcement brought a deafening chorus of boos from the audience, many of whom were supporters of the America First movement hoping to engage the speakers and challenge Kirk. Since the event, a number of establishment media outlets have covered the America First movement and its confrontation with Conservative Incorporated, with the typical smears and slanders being leveled against a group of largely young American nationalists concerned about the future of their country, the direction of the conservative movement, and President Trump's America First agenda, which has been stymied by the deep state and virtually the entire political and media establishment for decades now, if not the entire 20th century and now the 21st. In response, Fuentes argued that the America First movement does not have an issue with Donald Trump Jr. or the president. Rather, they are focused on exposing the faux conservatives surrounding the presidents and dominating the broader movement. They want their voices heard, and engaging mainstream conservative figures at public events has proven to be a successful strategy. Our problem is with Charlie Kirk's TPUSA organization that shuts down and smears socially conservative Christians and supporters of President Trump's agenda, Fuentes said in part following the fallout from the UCLA event. "We are America first," Fuentes summed up the predicament the president finds himself in currently, indicating the forces the America First movement is opposing. President Trump's agenda has been subverted from the beginning by people in his White House or inner circle who didn't vote for him, aren't loyal to him, and actively oppose his policies, Fuentes noted. They are the globalist GOP swamp trying to recapture the party from Trump and his voters, he said. Tariff threat work to slow illegal immigration. By Robert Romano, apprehensions on the southern border fell for the fourth consecutive month to 52,546 in September from a peak of 144,116 in May, a 63.5% drop, reflecting a major slowdown in migration according to the latest data from Customs and Border Patrol, and it all proves that President Donald Trump's tariffs are working. The decline came after the June 7 deal between Trump and Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, which avoided Trump's threatened tariffs. These would have gone live on May 30, starting at 5% on June 10, then 10% on July 1, and then up to 25% by October. At the time, Trump wrote on Twitter, on June 10, "The United States will impose a 5% tariff on all goods coming into our country from Mexico, until such time as illegal migrants coming through Mexico and into our country stop. The tariff will gradually increase until the illegal immigration problem is remedied, at which time the tariffs will be removed." Details from the White House to follow. Then the deal was cut days later, which included a Mexican military deployment to interdict the incoming migrant caravan from Central America, as well as provision for asylum seekers to wait out pending hearings in Mexico without being allowed to cross into the U.S. according to the text of the joint agreement. Mexico will take unprecedented steps to increase enforcement to curb irregular migration, to include the deployment of its National Guard throughout Mexico, giving priority to its southern border. Mexico is also taking decisive action to dismantle human smuggling and trafficking organizations as well as their illicit financial and transportation networks. In addition, the U.S. has expanded the migrant protection protocols. Per the agreement, those crossing the U.S. southern border to seek asylum will be rapidly returned to Mexico, where they may await the adjudication of their asylum claims, and Mexico will authorize the entrance of all of those individuals for humanitarian reasons, in compliance with its international obligations. While they await the adjudication of their asylum claims, if the agreement in itself immediately proved that Trump could negotiate such an agreement, and that Mexico was willing to participate given the proper inducements, it is the substantial downturn in migration now that shows that it might be sticking. Critics at the time said it couldn't be done. At the time, the Wall Street Journal editorial board on May 31 had predicted, "The first problem here is that Mr. Trump is blaming Mexico for a mess it can't solve. Perhaps it could better control its border with Guatemala, but the caravans north are often led by gangs that know how to bribe or avoid police," the Council on Foreign Relations on June 5 stated. President Andrés Manuel López Obrador of Mexico can't staunch the flow of people from his neighbors to the south. But that was wrong, way wrong. Apparently, Mexico could do a lot more than it was letting on, including by deploying its military and enforcing agreements to protect asylum seekers, and all it took was a little pressure from Trump, who had already shown that he was willing to wield tariffs against the much larger Chinese economy. They took him to heart, and now the number of migrants is plummeting. Without the tariffs, nobody would have been talking, and without Trump, nobody would have even tried.